My guest today, Hanna Albayati, is an author and activist who writes for the Egyptian-based Al Aaron Weekly. Based in Cairo, she's a member of the Executive Committee of the Brussels Tribunal, which is composed of intellectuals, artists, and activists who have denounced the logic of permanent war promoted by the American government and its allies, concentrating for the time being particularly on one region of the world, the Middle East. I'm also a member of the Tribunal's Advisory Committee. We last spoke with Hanna Albayati in October about an article that she co-authored which criticized the left intelligentsia that suspended its powers of analysis and came down unapologetically on the side of dictators as long as they were opposed by the United States, which is a problem that has hobbled the left since well before the Arab Spring. Now she has co-authored an article for the Al Aaron with Abdul Ilah Albayati and Ian Douglas that stresses the importance of implementing democracy in Egypt and throughout the Arab world, and which is far different than the one that we were told has a far different definition of democracy than the one we have been, are told is the goal of the neocons. Welcome, Hanna Albayati, to Takes on the World.
Thank you for having me on the program. Jeff, your voice is a little blurred.
I'm sorry? I didn't hear. Well, when last we spoke, you expressed an optimism for the future of the Egyptian society, which is now experiencing its birth pangs. In a recent article, which you co-authored, you stress a transition from a neoliberal comprador police state, which was Egypt under Mubarak, to a state that now must focus on becoming a democratic state that focuses on the welfare of its people. How optimistic are you about that prospect?
Well, I'm very optimistic. I think, of course, there will be some obstacles, some mistakes, but in the long run, I'm optimistic that Egypt and other Arab countries will actually operate this transformation, which is in the interest of the Arabs, but which is also in the interest of developing countries who have stagnating economies and could not see the positive aspects of places like Egypt needing development, and therefore their expertise too. It's not opposed to Western interests that the Arab world develops.
Well, you know, in the West, there's a whole way of looking at what's been happening in the Middle East, and there's this fear of we don't have the communist bogeyman. It's not Al-Qaeda, but it's the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists. And perhaps you could talk about the role that they are playing, and the Muslim Brotherhood recently won the election. Are they inclined, or how do they fit into this picture you're presenting?
Well, something homogeneous about the Muslim Brothers. There's a lot of tendencies inside the Muslim Brothers. The Egyptian Muslim Brothers are quite moderate in their understanding of how to apply Islamic law. And recently they have agreed and helped develop what is called the Azhar document, which was produced by this institution, Islamic institution called Al-Azhar, which stipulates very clearly that the state itself, the institutions of the state, would remain secular, so that the Islamist inclination of their politics will not change the nature of the state. This is different from the Salafists, who have been also elected in parliament, who represent about 20% of the votes, and who are much more radical in the interpretation of Islam and the Sharia law, Islamic law. The mainstream Muslim Brothers are very moderate. They are quite democratic, and they've been very clever in convincing the Egyptian electorate that they would make a change. They were very oppressed under Hosni Mubarak's regime. And the Egyptian people think that it's time to give them a chance. They are well known. They have done a lot of social work throughout the years, like providing health, providing after school activities, helping for all kinds of social issues, for the weak, the orphans, the elderly. So they are respected socially. And the Egyptians want to give them a chance to make legislation at the time being. But this doesn't mean that they will be in power forever. So they will be judged upon what they deliver, of course, like in any electoral system.
Now, we still have the situation with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which represented the military under Mubarak, and they also had extreme or dominated the economic sector of Egyptian society. Do you see, or how do you see the military, the army, surrendering that aspect, the economic aspect of Egyptian society to the people?
Well, I think it's a very problematic question. Many people condemn the fact that there is very little transparency on how do they actually hold these economic powers and how much profit do they make, etc., which is a question of concern. But I'm not concerned with the fact that a big part of the economy remains in the public sector. As long as it is under the defense ministry, it remains in the public sector, and it's very important for Egypt's security, including its food security, that this kind of industries, whether it's the wheat, the bread, the gas, like the basic necessities, remain in the public sector. What has to be done is that it be transferred from a military management to a civilian management, but it doesn't mean privatizing this part of the economy, and this should be clarified. Otherwise, I think in every country at some point, I mean, I'm French, I was brought up in France, and the army in France was used to bring expertise to the people. The people would be conscripted or drafted to the army, and they would learn some kind of professions. They would operate some side of the economy, and nobody was calling this a military dictatorship. It's later on that developed countries decided to have volunteer professional armies for many, many decades. The army was responsible for the security of many key industries of the state, and I see this as a natural process.
Well, of course, we had a conscript army in this country until 1971, in the protest against the Vietnam War. The Nixon administration decided to end it and make it into a professional army, and had they kept what they called the conscription, that Iraq War would not have lasted 10 years if it had started at all, and certainly we would still be not be in Afghanistan. So there is something to be said for that. As opposed to the professional army, which had become simply a lifetime job. There has been in Egypt, since I wrote you, a number of protests and talk. We had this tragedy that happened after the soccer match in Port Said, where Port Said fans attacked those from Cairo. What political implications did that have? Because it rocked the country with more than 70 people being killed.
Well, I mean to say that some nations are more used to violence than others. I want to say that the Egyptian people culturally are extremely peaceful. And they've been collectively in shock since this catastrophe, and it's not like it's beyond politics, it's beyond understanding. Collectively, they cannot imagine that 73 of their youngsters died that way. Many believe that this was an organized massacre, and the question is, who is behind this organized plan of slaughtering so many young people? There are many scenarios. There is an investigation going on, but for sure, the majority of the Egyptians think that as long as the security of the state not maintain them. They can criticize the performance of the military council, because ultimately the military council is supposed to be responsible for the security of the citizens in this period. I think many believe that it is like some parties who are what they call the remnants of the older regime who actually planified this massacre so as to divide the people. And it didn't work. I mean, everybody condemned the massacre. Nobody believed that it was the supporters of Port Said's football team that actually did the killing. And there are many signs that some third party was involved in this incident. But what happened afterwards was very, very big protests in Cairo and in Suez and in Port Said and Alexandria, some calling for the immediate transfer of power to a civilian authority, and some calling to put pressure on the parliament so that the parliament actually really has a clean investigation about who is behind, and that people would be brought to accountability. Like, if there is an organized plan, then that there'll be a trial and some convictions of criminals. It's unclear until now. There's a lot of speculation on who is behind this.
Well, that was I was leading to, because I also, earlier there had been the bombing of the Coptic churches, and it appeared that there was some forces, outside forces, trying to provoke or disrupt or destabilize the country at this point.
Totally. There are currently many attempts, and they take different shapes. And so there is the attempt against the Coptic minority, but there is also a lot of armed robberies of banks. There are some kidnappings. There is like what seems to be an attempt to bring the country into chaos. And the military council has that they knew who was behind and that they would soon proceed to some arrests. You know, it's very unclear. So we all have like our own interpretation, and there's a lot of rumor going around. So I cannot tell you more than this, actually.
Well, in that
what
light...
What I know is that there is like a kind of people who think that there should be a transfer to a civilian authority, but they do not provide the mechanisms by which to do that, you know. So I'm just concerned of what would be the legal basis and the legitimacy of that civilian authority, what would be its mandate, for how long, how do we guarantee that this civilian authority doesn't actually act as a new regime. You know, it raises many question marks in terms of legality, how to transfer this power if we are not holding elections.
Well, this brings up the question, is how powerful is the parliament at this point?
At this point, the parliament cannot form a government legally. So it can pass legislations, but it cannot have a government. It can participate in choosing who will be the 100-strong committee who will draft the constitution, therefore influence the content of the new constitution. It can bring members of the government under investigation. It can file cases to the prosecutor, but it cannot form a government, which is for the parliament very problematic. At the time being, all the executive power are in the hands of the military council.
Now, there was, at least in the Western press here, quite a bit of talk about who is going to be running for the presidency of Egypt, and Mohamed al-Baradei has mentioned, and he has pulled out. There's Abu Musa from the Arab League. Are there any individuals that are emerging that are likely to at this point to become the president of Egypt?
I wouldn't choose one before there is, I wouldn't say, give you a name before there is a proper campaign. The campaign will open on March 10, apparently, this is the latest declaration. What I know is that in all the polls that have been conducted throughout the year, some have been done by national institutions here and some have been conducted by international institutions, Al-Baradei always arrived the last, and he didn't make more than 2.4%. So Al-Baradei does not stand a chance in being elected. So when he withdraws from the race that has not even started, I'm sorry, I have to laugh. But he's very popular in the a part of the revolutionaries who are upper middle class, westernized, who do stand very strongly for human rights, but what they understand by human rights is mainly individual human rights. And he has managed to have a lot of echo in that part of the movement. But it's not, he's not popular at all in like less privileged parts of the society.
Well, in your article, you kind of refer to what you call the pushtist, those in the movement who believe there's a vanguard that knows more than the people, that should take power, can take power, as opposed to going through democratic processes. And I presume you were referring to some of those who were out in Tahrir Square and believed the revolution was going to be an easy task. Maybe you could explain your criticism of the cultures of what you call avant-gardism and neoliberalism versus neoliberalism.
Yes, well, it's and it's recent. I can feel that there is already a kind of retrospect and some self-criticism. But one part of the Tahrir youth spent a lot of time during the year to protest continuous human rights violations, which they have all the right to do and actually are right. But they didn't develop like a credible program and alternative, and they didn't try to reach outside the square. But lately, they started to bring the protest outside the square and to ally with labor unions or student unions and try to mobilize in smaller towns, etc. But for a long time, they concentrated their protests on Tahrir Square, and unfortunately, they didn't see that they didn't mobilize the street and didn't actually understand what they wanted. And a part of them called to boycott the elections. And the next day, there were millions of Egyptians queuing, proud for the first time to participate in what they saw as a fair election. So there was a kind of gap in the communication between this youth and the ordinary people. I think they are now starting to really try to concentrate for local elections and try to organize better and more, less segregated, because they are very divided into different, you know, like movements and alliances, etc., so as to have a much more powerful platform in the future. But this was, I think, one of the mistakes, and I think it comes from this vanguard attitude, which positions itself like it's been better than the people, what is good for the people themselves, you know?
So, in a sense, there is kind of a backlash on the part of the general populace, particularly when they did have a chance to have an election for the first time, to be told they shouldn't participate.
Yeah, and actually, the Islamists, whether it's the Muslim Brothers or the Salafists, were much more clever in terms of political tactics, not to lose the it's not to lose. They were very, very clever to reach to, reach out to the population. The liberals and the leftists made their campaign from a negative point of view. Most of it was saying, we don't have enough time to organize, it's unfair, the Islamists are much more better organized and better known than us, we need more time. On another aspect, they were very critical of the Islamists, and they played the game of the identity, is Egypt an Islamic state or is it not an Islamic state, and they demonstrated a lot against the Islamists. Whereas the Islamists didn't demonstrate against people, they demonstrated for something. You know, they were giving like hope and propositions to the people. So the inclination of the Egyptians was to trust better the Islamist movement, and I find it completely natural. They were much clearer in what is their program and what do they hope once they would be in power, etc., etc. The square concentrated on issues that concern most the square, like, for example, the campaign towards the military trial of civilians. It's a very, very justified campaign. We all oppose military trials for civilians, but it's not as if 85 million people will face the decision that they might be tried by a military court, you know? So to concentrate on such issues means that the population didn't get some answers like, okay, but once you will be in parliament, what will you do about the gasoline, what you will do about the education, what you will do, you know, like things that really concern the people.
Well, the economy is in terrible shape. How much was this a class issue? It seems like it was a
class issue. For sure, and the economy, actually, like, there cannot be a welfare state without money to redistribute. And at the time being, unfortunately, due to the neoliberal character of the previous regime, like Egypt has, I think, one third of its economy depending on tourism, on foreign visitors, and they have not come back. It's a year that this entire side of the economy is collapsing. The people are bankrupt in the touristic areas. So, I hope that the youth of Tahrir starts to formulate more program-based ideas that could appeal to the population. And meanwhile, while they are not well represented in parliament, they have all the right to put pressure via the street as long as it remains peaceful. I think it's very dangerous to radicalize this movement and to enter in constant violent clashes with the security forces, because it's used by the security forces as a proof that these young people are only excited, or, you know, that they want to destabilize the state, or that they are anarchists, and they use it to get the population to fear them.
That's interesting comment. My guest is Hanna Albayati, and she's in Cairo. We're talking about the situation in Egypt. In the papers today, I mentioned before I called you, the big story, of course, is the arrest and of a number of NGOs, closing down of a number of foreign NGOs, including three American NGOs, which have a long history of interference in foreign governments in the name of democracy, the National Democratic Institute, the Republican Institute, both of which are part of the National Endowment for Democracy. Of course, their version of democracy is not quite the one you're talking about. And this has caused, and the fact that they're going to be brought to trial, and one of them is a son of a former American congressman and the U.S. Transportation Minister, and the fact that Egypt has not released them, is going to bring them to trial, has caused members of U.S. Congress to talk about cutting off the $1.5 billion in aid that the U.S. gives to Egypt under the Camp David Agreement. And yet there are polls, I saw yesterday a poll saying that the Egyptians don't want or don't care about the USA. How is that story playing in Egypt, and what's your take on it?
Well, I think that the revolutionaries are against the prosecution of the NGOs. I will again differ from them. I actually think it's a matter of sovereignty, and that there's no country in the world that accepts that foreign funding would invest in political activities on its soil. That, you know, like that we need to know, any state would require to know what are the exact activities that you're conducting, what's your source of funding, and agree if you're licensed or not if you're licensed. In the case of some of these NGOs, there is no license, and they are spending millions of dollars in Egypt doing nobody knows what exactly. So I just think it's totally justified from the judiciary authority. And let's not forget that it is not the military council who has put them on trial. It is the independent judicial authority of Egypt who thinks that they are breaking the law, which they are, you know. So that there would be an investigation, I think, is totally legitimate, and that there should be legislation about who does what on Egyptian soil is necessary. We are not Switzerland. We are the neighbors of Israel. You know, we are in a region where there is a lot of conflict and problems that could affect Egypt and its stability and its sovereignty. I am for the prosecution of NGOs to investigate what actually are they doing, who are they financing. I think it's normal.
I know the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a parent organization of the National Democratic Institute and the Republican Institute, which it funds. The head of it is a very strong supporter of Israel, and which probably comes as no surprise to you. And they were founded during the Reagan administration to conduct the anti-communist activities as part of the U.S. Cold War against the Soviets, and they have been maintained there. They've been active throughout the Middle East and still are today. So this is, it's interesting that this comes up now, it's an irony, as someone wrote an article the other day, who is the United States to try and teach democracy to any place in the world when billions of dollars, who has the most billions, determines who wins elections in the United States. It's some
exactly.
Poor example. And obviously the United States has national interest, which these people in these organizations represent. My guest again is Hanna Albayati. If you have questions for Hanna Albayati, the number here, of course, is 895-2448. There are a number of individuals who became very prominent during the Arab Spring, including a young man who worked with Google, who I heard him interviewed the other day. Have any of these people who were, let's say, widely interviewed by the Western media, have they maintained any kind of prominence? Are they involved in politics today? You were talking about some of them learning from their experiences, but in terms of some of those who are more prominent, have they become involved in a meaningful way?
Well, it really depends on who. Everybody is still involved. I mean, the entire nation has turned political. There's not one Egyptian who doesn't spend his day talking about politics, whether he wants to participate in the protest or whether he disagrees with the protest, whether he supports the military council or whether he supports a transfer to a civilian authority. What about the trial of Hosni Mubarak, corruption, etc.? The entire nation discusses politics. Of these activists, some were already involved in political parties, and some were more like social media activists. and all of them continue one way or another. Rene in particular is trying to form an alliance that would be broader than those who support street action on. So he's trying to gather several alliances and party movements to try to unify together. Some have actually become candidates, and two or three of the Tahririan revolutionaries are now MPs in the parliament. Really, it depends, but no one believes that the revolution is finished, or that it was only the 18 days of January and February. It's an ongoing movement, and everybody is very mobilized and involved. And from whatever his situation is, the young filmmakers are trying to document the clashes and prove that the police forces are using excessive force. The artists are making graffiti all over Cairo. You know what I mean? And some are building more long-term initiatives, like cultural centers where all these aspects will be discussed. Or they are active in their own unions. The young engineers, for example, are very, very, very revolutionary. In the doctors' union, there's an entire new wave of post-revolution activism. In the education, in the teachers' syndicate. So everybody's active at its level, for sure.
You mentioned everyone's politically aware, and I know there's so many political and economic problems within Egypt, but you also mentioned that Egypt is in the Middle East and your neighbor is Israel, an immediate neighbor to the north, which, of course, they have this treaty ongoing since 1979. What is the thinking of the people, if you can put it generalized about it, with the talk of the likelihood, increasing likelihood of an Israeli attack on Iran? Is that much discussed?
Sorry, the voice was not clear enough. Could you repeat?
Oh, yes. Is there, with the political consciousness of in Egypt and the discussion and the awareness of Israel and the Camp David agreement, but in general, is there concern or discussion of the possibility that's increasing of an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities and what that would mean for Egypt?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very tricky one. Basically, nobody would support a strike on Iran. At the same time, everybody is very critical of Iran's role, whether in Iraq or in Syria. So there are two levels, you know. Nobody wants an escalation of a war that would turn regional and that would destabilize the entire attempt to have a transition to democracy. At the same time, they support Iran's right to develop nuclear power. Like, they would support their own right to develop nuclear power, but they are very concerned about what's going on in Syria at the time being. This is like a big difference between Western leftist analysts who actually believe that politics is a matter of rhetoric, and they think that because Bashar al-Assad declares himself anti-imperialist, he is an anti-imperialist. The Arabs are not fooled at all, and everybody stands in solidarity with the Syrians who are trying to make this dictatorial power fall. I've never met someone here who would not support the Syrian revolution. In terms of the strike, the Israeli strike in Iran, I think there's a general understanding that these two states serve each other, and nobody really believes that they would strike Iran, you know?
Well, it would be, there's also, if we're getting down to the end of the hour, but there's also, of course, talk about an Israeli strike on Gaza again, But would Egypt, the Egyptian military, sit by and for another operation cast lead?
No, I think it would be impossible for Egypt to remain silent if Israel hits any Arab, whether it's Gaza or whether it's Lebanon or whether. But I actually think that Israel is quite isolated and could not do such a thing at the time being. You know, they might like strike here and there, but I don't think that they. It would be suicidal to start a big military campaign right now. You become like Ramsey, who is logic, saying you have a problem, extend it. But I'm sure that the Israeli society is not homogeneous also, and that there are some people who are actually opposed to extending the problem, you know?
Well, Hanna Albayati, I want to thank you. We've come down to the end of the hour. I want to thank you for spending time with us and giving us your interpretation, your analysis of what's happening in Egypt. I do appreciate you talking with you again and wish you all the best.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.